This is a podcast for Tuesday, February 15th, 2011, Theories of Reality. So, to start out with, I thought we'd review for the exam. So, remember I said last week I'd open the exam early, right after class today. It's available, and we're going to go through the review now and take the first half class there and do some other things after that. As soon as we see how long the review takes. So I'm being prudent and starting with the review to make sure we have sufficient time for it. So we're starting out with chapter 4, I believe. Right, so the exam will be on just chapter 4 and 5. So chapter 4, life after death, first issue, cryonics. Actually, let me see if I can test a look at here. So you should know the distinction between cryonics and cryogenics. And somebody tell me, what is that distinction? This might be something you want to put in your note card if you can't remember it.
Cryonics is the study of cold energy, and cryonics is the freezing of...
Did you say cryonics twice?
Oh, sorry. Cryogenics is the actual freezing of human bodies.
No, we got them backwards.
Oh, I try again?
So there's only two ways it can go, right? So you have cryonics and cryogenics.
Good thing it's multiple choice. I can rule that out.
Keyboard. So somebody else? Cryogenics. Cryonics. Which is which?
Cryonics is the practice of freezing the body of a person. Cryonics. And then cryogenics is the physics of low temperature effects on biological systems.
Right, so if you've heard the term thrown around a lot, if you can remember, the terms are usually used wrong. People usually use the word cryogenics when they mean cryonics. So, like, remember the guy in the video with the rabbit hearts? He was trying to get the rabbit heart to beat and thinks the idea of wanting to be immortal is bizarre. Who would want to live forever? Well, he's a cryogenicist, but he's not a cryonicist, because he's just interested in low-temperature medicine. I have a friend who designs computer-controlled cooling systems with liquid nitrogen for complex industrial processes. He does cryogenics. It's not restricted to biology. It's also, you can have cryogenics in physics too. It's just what happens at extremely low temperatures. Cryonics is the idea of freezing the dead. All right. I should know the founder of the cryonics movement, Robert Edinger, and his book, The Prospect of Immortality. That's Robert Edinger. He was featured in the film Immortality on Ice, the video I showed in class here. Those of you in the podcast would have gotten the visuals. For people over here, he was the kind of old guy that said, we can remember what he said. He said, when are you dead? You're dead when you can't be revived. So your whether you're dead or not doesn't depend on your state now. It depends on your state in the future. Yeah.
So he's the guy who discovered cryonics, and we should know...
Yeah, Robert Edinger. E-T-T-I-N-G-E-R. Robert Edinger. I think he's bolded in... Let's see. The Prospect of Immortality. He's in here someplace. There's Drexler. Technology, Man, Supernatural. Oh, here we go. He's on the top of page 68. I should have bolded his name here. It's the top of page 68. Robert Edinger. And he will be on the exam. Okay. see. You should know that one of the main problems with cryonics is freezing damage. That as cells freeze, water inside the cell leaves it to join the water on the outside and forms jagged ice crystals. And so the water leaving the cell sort of deflates it and weakens it, and then the jagged ice crystals puncture it. And then all the contents leak out, and it's a big mess. And there's catastrophic damage. And so natural organisms like frogs and worms adapt to this. Their body secretes these sugary substances, which round the crystals and keep ice from forming as much. And so cryonics, one of the ways they try to mimic nature is they use these sugary substances, glycerol of various kinds. It's sort of like human antifreeze, except for it's not toxic. And so they perfuse the person's body with this cryoprotectant. They replace their blood with this synthetic sugar substance, and it keeps the freezing damage from being as great. So those are called cryoprotectants. A cryoprotectant is any substance that keeps the cell structure intact while the body's being frozen. And then for the freezing damage, which the cryoprotectants don't protect against, there's the prospect of nanotechnology in its earliest stages of development now. But if you think about the logarithmic advancement of technology and how technology is potentially doubling every year and a half, you think about 100 years ago, you had people riding around on horses still. The first automobiles were just coming out, and they weren't in wide use. There were dirt roads. A lot of people didn't have indoor plumbing. Most people worked on a farm. The height of technology was the pocket watch. Modern medicine was penicillin. And when the dentist went and went to yank out your teeth with a pair of pliers, he might have some nitrous oxide to give you. And so you think about, and then maybe 50 years ago, they had a room they had a computer that would fit in a single room, right? Then there would be this huge computer. A computer that wouldn't even equal the computing power of my laptop, and probably wouldn't even equal the computing power of my watch, would take up a whole room, and certainly most people here have little phones in their pocket, smartphones, which have more computing power than the most advanced computer in the 50s. And there's this huge array of vacuum tubes and wires and ticker tapes. My dad, when I was a kid, my dad used to bring home these punch cards. And there are these computer cards. When you're at a program, you put in these little punch cards with numbers in them, and it would it would run a certain program based on the numbers you punched out. And now all that stuff's dinosaur year stuff. It's and so if you think about the rate at which the technology is advancing at an ever increasing rate, you can think, well, 200 years, say 100 years in the future, is not going to be simply as much advancement as we've had in the last 100 years. It's going to be, I don't know what somebody could calculate what it would be. But it will be 100 times the advancement we've had in the last 100 years. It'll be some astounding number, because it's doubling every year and a half, computing power and the associated technology. And then there are also certain plateaus we might reach. So once we have real artificial intelligences, for example, once we have computing power, which will give us artificial intelligences, the artificial intelligences can work on our technological and engineering problems too. And so you have to add that into the mix. And just like today, for example, a philosophy department, you'd have like secretaries, and secretaries would be typing up exams by hand, and instructors would be either writing out exams longhand, or maybe they'd be giving their multiple choice exams, they might be dictating them to a secretary who would write them down in longhand and then go type them on a manual typewriter. You think about all that inefficiency. And now, you know, I got my little laptop, or people have got their little iPads, and they just click, and they can do their exams. They can grade their exams online. So you just think about just how far things have gone just in the last, you know, couple of decades. And so the future is going to be a lot stranger than you'd expect. So this is what chronicists are counting on, the fact that in the future a lot of things are going to be possible that aren't possible today. And so that's why, you know, you ask this question, well, what about aging? And Ben Best has, you know, he deals with some of these questions, and Ben Best argues that aging is a curable disease, and that we know that the aging is made up of a bunch of different separate biological processes, and we know a little bit about them. We don't know a lot about them, but we're just starting to understand. We understand, you know, that part of it's genetic programming, part of it's kind of wear and tear on our DNA. Some of it is a limit in reproducing, although not all cells have what's known as the Hayflick limit. So you should know what the Hayflick limit is. It says that this Hayflick limit is a limit on cell division, and it limits human lifespan to about 120 years. But not all cells have the Hayflick limit. Cancer cells and reproductive cells seem to be immortal. There seems to be no limit to how many times they can divide. So if we can figure out why it is that those cancer cells can keep on reproducing over and over and over again without limit, or why those reproductive cells can do that, and figure out how to make our regular cells do that, that's a step in the right direction. And then there's other things like you get all this junk from metabolic processes that doesn't get flushed out of your system, and it can cause problems. You have these telomeres, which are the ends of your DNA, and they're sort of like, there's these kind of sheaths on the end. They're kind of like shoelace, those things on the end of shoelaces, if anybody wears shoes. I'm surprised there's still laces now. I expect everything to be Velcro. But, you know, then they had a shoelace. You have those little plastic nubs in the end of shoelaces. And that's kind of what they do. Well, they wear away after a while, and then the ends of your DNA get frayed, and then they get damaged. And then they start to make errors, right? And when they start to make errors, your body breaks down. And you start to get, you know, moles and growths and the weakenings of your various body system, depending on how many cells are, you know, not reproducing properly. And so if you can figure out how to either alleviate or undo some of the damage, to maybe increase the number of times cells can reproduce and so on, you're sort of on your way. And what Beth says is that the aging is a series of physiological processes. It's not a metaphysical state. And he talks a little bit about free radicals damage too. This is from the metabolic processes. And if you eat your veggies and have lots of fruit and maybe take some vitamin pills, that can be helpful too. See, philosophical issues, religious issues.
Do you think perhaps, like, there's some kind of, like, societal desire to die based on, like, the conditions of the culture at a certain period of time that'll influence, like, the average death age?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Most people seem to be okay with death because they believe in afterlife. And I met people that don't believe in afterlife, because I talked about this in class, and say, well, just when it's my time to go, you know, that's going to be it. And as long as I've had a good life, I'm not going to be too broken up about it. And so there's a kind of a culture that accepts death. And this is one of the things that Edinger says. He says that, you know, I don't want death imposed on me. And, I want to live as long as I feel good about life. And that sort of attitude, I think, is pretty rare. Most people think it's like, well, when society says, or when it's my turn to die, I need to be part of the natural cycle and align myself with either what the authorities say, or what society says, or what the rules say, or what's natural. And And you know, and I don't want to be selfish. If I live too long, I'd be taking up resources, and that would be selfish. And so I should, you know, sacrifice myself essentially. But it may be that in the future that people have that live when people are living. If people are living longer, it's hard to say what changes might happen. It might be that life is becomes more precious because it's possible to live it longer. And it might be the reason that people here think life is cheap is because death seems inevitable. If death no longer seems inevitable, people might sing a different tune about, live free, die young, or whatever. That their attitude might change. And he talks about psychological issues, you know, why if you lived a long time, would you... You know, what about your friends and loved ones that would all die? Transferring consciousness to computers. You should know that what kills you is ischemic damage to your brain. That after you get what's called brain death, which is separate from your heartbeat ceasing. Your heartbeat ceasing causes your blood not to be pumped to your brain, and that causes your brain not to get oxygen, because your blood's carrying oxygen to your brain. That's one of the reasons your blood circulates. One of the reasons. And if your brain doesn't get enough oxygen and it's a pretty short period of time at room temperature, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, after 5 or 6 minutes, you start to get irreparable damage to your brain. By the time you're looking at 10 or 15 minutes, it's a pretty dicey proposition that you'd come back as a fully conscious person. So that's the damage that really is, that Cryonicists trust nanotechnology will be able to fix. So nanotechnology will be around to fix that kind of damage and also the damage from freezing.
Called ischemic damage?
ischemic. I-S-C-H-E-M-I-C. Ischemic damage. And it's oxygen deprivation. Or from oxygen deprivation. And don't worry about the legal problems. You should know that cryonics may seem expensive. However, you can fund it with a life insurance policy. So it's actually not expensive at all. And the younger you are, the cheaper it is, because the cheaper your premium will be. So most people in this room, your life insurance, your cryonic suspension, it's going to cost you less than a night of pizza and beer. Right? Probably less than going to the movies and buying popcorn. And so you think about it that way, it's not that much. You think about $100,000, that seems like a lot. $100,000 for a life insurance policy for somebody, under the age of 30 is a drop in the bucket. You're talking about $10 or $20 a month or something like that. And of course, if you get older, it's more money. But then the question is, if you have a shot at immortality, how much is that going to be worth to you? All the other stuff you can't take with you.
Would there be any advantage to cryonics in space?
Space actually messes up your body.
Yeah, it's like bad. Well, I don't know if you're...
Well, you have to work out to keep your muscles in tone.
But if you're frozen, I think...
If you're dead, but not moving.
But if they plan on bringing you back,
then they would have to be back on Earth, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure about, I mean, one advantage might be that you're never going to thaw out if there's a proper temperature controls, and that you're near the cold vacuum of space. So, the vacuum would do all sorts of things to you, if you were exposed to the vacuum, but it's going to be really cold. It's not like you're in Phoenix, Arizona, which is, Alcor, I guess they really like the symbolism of the Phoenix rising from the grave or something, but that seems like a bad place to put a cryonics facility. I think that Robert Edinger, when he picked Detroit, he had the right idea. Eugene would be a good place. Pretty soon we'll be able to have permafrost burials here. It's supposed to snow tomorrow. Anyway, so you should know it's you know, you can fund your suspension through a inexpensive life insurance policy. So Cryonics isn't just for the rich.
It's just for the dead.
Yeah. Or for the soon to be dead, or people who think they will someday die. Right? Who want to make plans for the future. It's just like, think about this as people go out and buy life insurance. Think about this as a death insurance policy. So and then of course he talks about you might want to not get $200,000 and then put that $100,000 in some sort of a safe investment, and then think about compound interest and stock splits over 100 years, and you're talking big money there, probably enough to pay off the life insurance company if they're still around and come after you for the money that they paid out initially for your suspension. Because you're not quite dead yet.
Do you have to be frozen while you're still alive?
You don't. Usually what they do is they wait in the wings while you die. And most people don't die suddenly. Usually people get sick and then they're in a hospital for a long period of time. And usually they're in and out of the hospital. And then finally the doctor says they're going to keel over in a week. And so remember that there was that old guy, I can't remember his name, but he was talking about his wife Terry and how Terry was embarrassed that she didn't die on time, and the Cryonics guy, the Alcor guys, are waiting for her to die, and it's like, oh, Terry's still kicking, because it's against the law to kill somebody. In Oregon, I guess, you go through a bunch of legal rigmarole and you can get permission from the state. But everywhere else, it's against the law. And I think the Cryonics stuff, I don't know. I'm not sure actually how that would work out in Oregon. But if you're going to do cryonic suspension while you're alive, Oregon would be the place to do it. Oregon or Denmark, I guess, or Scandinavia, one of those places that allows doctor-assisted suicide. But you can do it right after you die. The idea is you want to get there as close as possible to when you die, because you don't want the... You want the brain damage to be as minimized as possible. So one of the things they'll do is if someone dies in the home, there's one guy. Well, actually, one of the early Cryonics guys, he had a coffin of dry ice in his house, and kept it stocked. And so when he died, they dumped him in the coffin of dry ice and called the helicopter, and the helicopter medevaced him to the Cryonics facility. That was the Stan Penska guy that in the video they suspended.
Picture some guy with a Titano and a bucket of liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, so I think that's it on that. You should know about what experiments with involving freezing have done. Let's see. So, experiments involving freezing. Let's see. So, large animals, like cats and dogs and primates, they've never been frozen and brought back. Now they can, large mammals and primates and dogs can be kept at very low temperatures but above freezing and be revived after several hours. So for big animals, they can be dead for a few hours at low temperatures, not freezing, but low temperatures. They come back with no apparent ill effects. And then there are smaller animals like worms and insects and frogs, as well as human embryos and tissues, that can be frozen solid and then brought back. Again, we had someone in the class just told me privately that this person was conceived in a petri dish, right? That embryo, that combination of sperm and eggs, or maybe the sperm and egg might have been stored separately, were stored in cold storage. They might have been sitting in there for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, And I'm not sure what the shelf life is, but I think they can be indefinite. There have been lawsuits about people die and then they got a bunch of reproductive material, and there's a question about who owns it. And I think there was a case of a woman, she took her dead husband's frozen sperm, impregnated herself, had a child, and then used that as a basis for an inheritance from his other son or something. I can't remember. But you can think of like there are all sorts of legal problems might emerge from these things. Anyway, so the long and short of it is large animals can be dead for a few hours and brought back from very cold temperatures, and then lower animals like frogs and insects, which have adapted over millions of years to freeze solid in the wintertime, can thaw out every year and come back with no ill effects. So the dream of the cryonicists is to try to do for humans what happens naturally in the frogs and the insects and the worms. So far, they have not had success.
Are they trying, genetic alterations on large animal DNA?
That might be a possibility. It seems like there would be so many genes that it would be, these processes are pretty complex, so that might be our understanding of genetic engineering currently isn't good enough. It might be that as soon as we could do something like that, we figured out how to extend aging dramatically already, or reverse it or something. So, let's see. See if I missed anything here. Oh, you should know also that cryonics is a small fringe movement. That is not a mainstream movement. There aren't a lot of famous people who've been frozen. There's maybe a few people. And then overall, I think at the time that video was made, there were 700 people who were signed up, and only about 70 that were frozen. So the numbers are really, really, really few. I mean, there's probably 30 times more Scientologists than there are cryonicists, if you think about it in those terms. And so they're not a very large movement, and it just hasn't taken hold. But maybe, after that first person comes back, guess what's going to happen? A lot of people will sign up. On the other hand, once the first person comes back, there'll probably be life-extending technology, which might make cryonics as sort of a matter of course be needless. It might be seen as just an emergency thing. Let's see. Oh, neurosuspension. What's neurosuspension? Head only. Head in a box. I forgot to bring my Acme cryo kit. I'll bring that on. I'll see if I can bring that on Thursday. I have an Acme cryo kit in my office for emergencies. Let's see. I think that about covers it. Nanotechnology.
Okay. How many questions is on the
test? Let me see. 50. Real faster here. Just want to make sure I didn't miss anything on chronics. Near-death experiences. Oh, what's the deal about? I think I mentioned this about old age. So, what do chronicists say about disease and old age? And they say basically, in the future, we'll be able to cure all those things. Look at how far medicine's come just in the last few years, genetic engineering and all kinds of antibiotics, new drugs, new treatments, stem cell research, all that stuff. Oh, what do the cryonicists say about overpopulation? What does Ben Best say about it in his article here? You remember that bit? It's a common objection. And his answer about that is that overpopulation only affects the underdeveloped world, or the developing world, whatever the PC term is for it, the third world they used to call it. And some people still use the word term third world. But really, overpopulation only happens in a place like India and China, where they still have the sort of agricultural economy. But what happens is, as people move from third world agriculture-based economy to second world industrial economy to first world high-tech information economy, interesting thing happens. People don't need a bunch of kids to function as their social security and as manual labor for the farm. And all of a sudden, they have all sorts of other things they can spend money on besides their damn kids, right? I can look at all these luxury goods I can buy. And so people end up having fewer and fewer kids. And in Western Europe, they have negative population growth. And it's only rising because of immigration from the third world. So Beth says that cryonics isn't going to cause overpopulation, because overpopulation is only a problem in the third world, where reproduction is high and technology is low. Okay, near-death experience, you should know like the common features of a near-death experience: the hovering over your body, going down a long dark tunnel with a blinding light at the end, feelings of peace and tranquility and euphoria, a whole life review, meeting beings of life or light or religious figures, and then being told that you have to go back, or being given a choice to go back, and then feeling yourself sucked back into your body. Long-term studies on near-death experiences show that about 12% of patients have some kind of experience. People that have like a long cardiac arrest, and then 18% of people that suffer from cardiac arrest have what's called a core near-death experience, including some of those phenomena I just mentioned, the long dark tunnel and the beams of light and so on.
So what were the statistics?
So 12% have some experience, 18% have a full-blown core near-death experience. So, not everybody, but, a significant number. So 12% have some experience. Sometimes people just look at their body and they don't go any farther than that. And it seems that the longer a person is dead, the more elaborate experience they have.
Is that 18% of the 12%, or is that of the whole?
18% of the whole group.
Okay.
So of the whole group, 12% have some experience. Of the whole group, 18% have that core near-death experience.
But on page 82 it says 18% had some, and 12% had core.
Oops, sorry, I switched those, didn't I? Sorry about that. Damn you, dyslexia. Twelve, and that wouldn't even make any sense with the 12 and the 18 switched, right? So 12% have the core experience. 18% have some experience. So 12% have the core experience, and then another 6% have some other kind of experience, I believe. Of the 344 patients tracked by the Dutch team, 18% had some memory of their period of unconsciousness, and 12%, one out of eight, had what the physicians called a core near-death experience. So the 18% is that part of the question? Is the 18% part of the total?
Like, would you say 30% have near-death experiences, 18 had some, and 12% had core?
Yeah, I think that's what this is saying. And on the exam, it'll just say 18% had some memory and 12% had a core experience. And the correct answer. That's a good question. I should write to the person that authored the study and make sure that's the case, because that's an important difference in the numbers. Let's see. Most near-death experiences are pleasant, although there are a handful of reported experiences of hellish experiences, people being torn apart and disemboweled by demons over and over again, people being burned up in flames, people feeling anguish and loss and despair, being kept in sort of a dark prison cell. And so you do get people that have these kinds of experiences too. Although it's pretty rare that people report these. Now, there's a question about are these underreported? You know, if you died and went to hell, would you share that with all your friends? Maybe not.
Yeah, why did you go to hell?
But maybe you want to warn them though. So I don't know. But that might be something that's underreported. But most experiences are pleasant. Could you perform an experiment which would confirm whether they're real or near-death experiences are real or not? Or I use the word veridical, because that avoids, you know, real for who. So could you design an experiment that would confirm or disconfirm the reality of near-death experiences? And the answer is yes. You just take some people, you stop their hearts, introduce some stimulus into the operating theater, you start their hearts again, and then you see if they can report what went on in the room while they were dead. If they can report accurately things that went in the room while they're dead, assuming you can revive them, then that would be evidence in favor of near-death experiences being real. Let's see. And just to jump on... let's see, going on with reincarnation. Could you have an experiment which would validate reincarnation? Again, I talked about this in class. The answer is yes. You take a random sample of people. You regress them under hypnosis. They tell you all about their past lives. You take this information to some historians. Don't tell them this is stuff you got under hypnosis by people to try to prove reincarnation. You just say, here's some historical data we'd like you to evaluate. And if you can evaluate, or if you can verify some minute historical details that the person, given their background, couldn't possibly have known, then that's proof in favor of reincarnation. If, on the other hand, they make a bunch of mistakes about history, it's either mistakes or it's all vague and general, and they lived in Atlantis and they were all kings and queens and princesses, and you say that's probably subconscious mind doing its thing.
And yeah. Like, what if your past life is in the future?
If it's in the future, is it? What if you experience a future life? You mean you regress a person, and the person all of a sudden starts talking about a life in the future, like they say?
Yeah, because their last life was actually in the future, because there's no time.
Well, it assumes there's no time, I suppose. There's a guy, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, 1-800-KARMA-4-U. Or drbrucegoldberg.com, I think. I might just Google for Bruce Goldberg. He has a book called Past Lives, Future Lives, where he talks about reports of people reporting future lives, and with just that idea you have there. So, now the thing about future lives is it's really hard to verify. Yeah. Unless someone says, in the future we figured out the unified field equation, I was a physicist. Or I will be a physicist in the future, and here's the equation. And he gives you the equation, and you're like, oh, there's the solution to the unified field theory. So you might be able to verify that too. So again, if someone comes up with something they couldn't possibly have known through normal means, just through fantasy, daydreaming, or their subconscious mind kind of cooking it up, then that might be evidence that these experiences are real.
Like, what percentage of accuracy would you have to have in order to prove reincarnation? Like, would just one person who seemed like had no knowledge of history, but gave a very accurate account of things they shouldn't have known of, and say 99% of the rest of the subjects were complete trash?
It would depend on how good that one example is and how well verified it is. The problem with these examples is they come from people that make a living trying to prove reincarnation, and they write books and they go on lecture tours, and so there's a big question about objectivity.
Do you have to have them blind too, as far as not knowing what they were doing necessarily?
Yeah, I think that to be as rigorous as possible, you'd want to do that. You'd want to make sure the researchers didn't even know what they were doing. They just got like a assigned list of tasks. Let's talk more about reincarnation. What's the problem with believing in immortality through an everlasting cycle of reincarnation? Well, one problem is that it seems that what you have there is a chain of persons united by the same spirit rather than one single person persisting through time. So you have like a causal chain of persons that person A creates person B creates person C, and what's the same? Just the spiritual stuff. But the persons are different. Each new lifetime, new personality, new memories, new choices, new values, maybe a new gender, new culture, new background. So everything about you is different. So what is the same? It's just the stuff you're made out of. Well, why should that matter? It seems that those are distinct persons. So if you think that who you are right now, your values and beliefs and your memories are part of who you are, then you won't live on. Basically, the stuff that you're residing in will live on, but you're just going to be like crammed down there at the bottom of somebody else's soul for all eternity until someone decides to go in for past life regression after, you know, after a night of drinking Romulan ale, they go to the space therapist and, you know, and go for some past life regression like they did in the olden times. But other than that, you're never going to come out as a personality, as the person you are now. So it seems like it's a faux or false sense of immortality, because to have life after death, there has to be a person who exists after your death, and that person has to be you. And if that person is you, then you have not survived your death. So then Hinduism suggests that at the end of all this reincarnation, you become one with God. So even if you were the same person through successive reincarnations, you're not going to be an individual anymore at the end. You're going to merge with God. There'll be no distinction between you and God, and so you won't even be a person anymore. And so even if you're able, you think that you're the same person from jumping from body to body, living life after life, finally it's all going to come to an end when you become one with Brahman. And again, the metaphor is like the drop of rain merging with the ocean. That drop of rain no longer exists as an individual drop of rain. There's just the ocean. And so in the same way, the individual person no longer exists when he becomes one with the Brahman, the Hindu, you know, God or ultimate reality. Now, the problem with Buddhism is a different kind of problem. The Buddhists, first of all, say you don't really have a soul, and there's that this idea that this candle flame analogy where you're just a flame isn't a substance, it's just something it's a process that can move through different vehicles. And so in the same way, you're kind of like that candle flame that can go from candle to candle. A candle flame isn't really a thing, but it can be communicated from one thing to another. So there's this bit that the Buddhist doesn't really believe you have a soul. It's this doctrine of anatman, or no self, or no soul. But then the other problem is once the no self gets to the end of the line, there's nirvana, which is a state of bliss. And it's not a personal form of existence, because you can't be a person, it's argued, if you don't have any desires. One of the things that all Buddhist scholars agree with is that nirvana is a state of no desire. Well, if you're in a state of no desire, are you going to do anything? Are you going to even think about anything? Or what would you think about? It would just like it's the eternal bliss. And so the idea is sort of the cosmic equivalent of, you know, being on really good drugs. or having an internal orgasm, or, you know, being, you know, like shooting the heroin and that feeling of high when you stick that needle in your vein, you first feel the, you know, that's what I heard. You just first feel that, you feel the chemicals start to take your action, and you're like, oh, yeah. It's like the eternal wow. Well, is that really a person? If it's just like the conscious, the conscious occupation with a total state of bliss and happiness, most people would say that's not a person. A person is someone who thinks, who does, who acts, who creates, who produces, who has relationships. Whereas in the nirvana, you're just sort of this vehicle of bliss or pleasure. So that would be an argument against the Buddhist concept. So, you know, you might say, in the instructor's opinion, neither the Buddhist nor the Hindu account of life after death maintains personal identity. So they're not real accounts of life after death because you don't survive the death of your body. And because there's no you in nirvana, there's no you at the end. And, well, actually, in both, there's no you at the end. In nirvana, you're not you because you don't have any desires. And then the Hindu version, you're not you because you've merged with God. Yeah.
Do we need to know the Western resurrection theory?
Yeah. So the Western resurrection theory, let me make sure I'm done with nirvana and the Eastern stuff.
Could you have purpose without desire?
Good question.
Maintain life after death in that sense.
I'm not sure about that. There's this idea that you can be motivated to do things without. You could be moved by duty or something without having a desire. That might be a rejoinder. So one account of life after death that doesn't run into conceptual difficulty is the Judeo-Christian view, where you leave your body for another world with your memories and personality intact. So if you have an immortal soul and your soul leaves your body and goes to be in heaven, you know, with other souls or with God, and then you know, maybe someday is rejoined with your body, that's not philosophically problematical because you have all your memory and your personality, and so it's maintained. It's only the problem with the Eastern view. But the Eastern view, which is the last thing I was going to say about the Eastern view, is that they don't believe in personal identity in the first place. The Buddha doesn't believe you're a person from 1 year to the next or 1 week to the next. The Hindus don't really believe that either. The Hindus will say, well, the soul is going from body to body and finally it'll merge with the Brahman and you'll become one with the Brahman or God. But then they'll turn around and say, but you're already one with God right now, you just don't realize it. So, and this whole world's an illusion. So really they don't believe in the individual person anyway, neither the Buddhists or the Hindus. Whereas the Western religions really do believe in the individual person, and that the person will never become one with God. They can have a relationship with God. They can be with God, but they won't be God, and they won't be part of God. And you know, heaven, all their desires will be satisfied. And then there's this idea of bodily resurrection we talked a bit about, and that's just and there's a few problems with that, maybe about if your body's totally destroyed, you know, are you the same person if that's all there is to you and God recreates it? And so that might be a problem for Judaism, but it's not really a problem for Christianity because the soul is a vehicle for the memory and personalities. And so as long as, you know, that disembodied soul exists in heaven and then God makes a new body, it doesn't matter whether it's exactly the same body as before or whether it's a duplicate of your old body or whether it's a new body, as long as your soul has all those memories and your personality and that personal essence in it that can be put back into that body. Let's see. Make sure I'm hitting all the important points here. Just generally about life after death. You should know there are certain beliefs about life after death, which are described in the text as kind of stories people tell themselves to make themselves feel better about death. So this idea that, I'll live on in the minds of those who love me. But that, you're not really living on in other people's minds, right? They have a copy or an impression of what you were like. It's like if I took a picture of you and then I kept it on my mantle and then you died, I'd say, well, Isaac is dead, but I still get this picture of Isaac, so in a way, he's still alive. No, Isaac would be dead. So it's not. There's no way in which a person lives on in the memory of others. That's a figure of speech. It's not really living on. And it's living on through making lasting contributions to society. Again, the old joke by Woody Allen: I don't want to become immortal through my work. I want to become immortal through not dying. Your atoms still existing after your body's decayed. People have this romantic idea that their molecules will still exist and they'll become stardust and they'll be pushing up the daisies and really why would you care that if your molecules still exist? Your molecules are what if you're a materialist, your molecules and atoms are what make up you. But it's the configuration and the organization. The atoms themselves, one hydrogen atom is the same as any other hydrogen atom. One carbon molecule is the same as carbon atom is the same as any other carbon atom. Organic molecules are organic molecules. So there's nothing special about those molecules existing once they've stopped being arranged in the order that allows your brain to function. Okay. I think that's it for life after death. Free will. Let's see. Should we take a break or let out early? I'm thinking what I'll do is I could do one of two things. I could go for another 20 minutes and finish the free will review, or we could take a break and we could get out 10 minutes later than that. How many people vote for just powering through till 10 after? Okay, that's a majority. Okay. Let's see. Definitions. Libertarianism. Libertarianism says a free act is when where the agent could have done otherwise under identical circumstances. A free act is one where you could have done otherwise under identical circumstances or under the same circumstances. So a free act is one where you could have done otherwise under identical circumstances, and there are such acts. So libertarians believe that's what free will is. A free act is one which you could have done otherwise under the same circumstances, and there are such acts. Determinism believes in that same part. A free act is one where the agent could have done otherwise under the same circumstances, under identical circumstances. So same definition of free will. But determinism says there are no such acts. There are no acts where you could have done otherwise under identical circumstances. If the circumstances have changed, they might result in different behavior on your part. But if the circumstances were exactly the same, there's only one thing you could do given those circumstances. So that's determinism. Determinism and libertarianism agree on what free will is. They just disagree on whether we have it or not. Compatibilism is the odd man out. Compatibilism says free will isn't having the power to do it otherwise under identical circumstances. Nobody has that power. So they agree with the determinists in that respect. But they also think that we have free will because otherwise nobody would be responsible for their actions. So they agree with the libertarians there. So they say both those guys must be wrong in their definition of free will. Free will means freedom from external compulsion or freedom from coercion. So free will means freedom from external compulsion or freedom from coercion. Not, you know, being able to do otherwise. So that's the compatibilist view. So with that definition of free will, free will is compatible, or free will might be compatible with determinism. Put it that way. At least they're not obviously logically contradictory. Because if you're doing what you want to, as long as, even though what you want to do is determined, then the compatibilist will say that you're free. Okay, and then we have all kinds of arguments about these views. So you have the argument from indeterminism in physics. So this is an argument for libertarianism. And it says, look, we're material beings. The material world is not determined. Therefore, we're not determined. You can't predict what's going on inside an atom. Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty says that you can't tell how fast an electron's going and where it's at the same time. It's, in principle, not predictable. And that's because, you know, the very nature, the fundamental nature of the atom is one of unpredictability.
This is
Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty.
Well, as an argument for determinism?
As an argument against determinism, for libertarianism. So an argument for libertarianism is that matter is not determined. I'm probably hitting this first. Usually I hit the argument from determinism in physics first.
So essentially that at quantum level everything is random, so it can't be determined.
Right. So therefore if you're a material being, then that leaves room for free will. Now an objection to that there's two objections. One, you could say, well, what if my body's determined, what if my body is not determined, but my soul is? What if there's theological determinism? What if God's, you know, predestined my soul to make certain decisions? And so, even though the physical world might not be determined, that doesn't mean the spiritual world isn't determined.
So, can this argument be only true for biological determinism?
Well, an objection might be that, well, what if you have a soul and it's determined? So that's just an objection to the argument from indeterminism in physics. So the argument from indeterminism says, look, we're material beings. We're not determined by physical laws. The matter is kind of chaotic and random. Therefore, we have free will. And one objection to that, you could just say, well, maybe we're not material beings. And so that's like, if that premise is false, the argument doesn't work. The other thing you could argue is that matter really is determined. You could argue that just because things at the microscopic level are sort of random and unpredictable doesn't mean things at the macro level, that your brain exists. You know, your brain weighs 3 pounds. It's like a large-sized organ. So your brain is a medium-sized material object, and those seem to obey pretty predictable laws of cause and effect. The other thing you could say is that maybe, that's the idea that maybe matter is determined after all. So actually, those are the two objections to the argument for indeterminism in physics. Now there's the argument for determinism in physics, which is just the opposite. It says we're material beings, matter obeys these laws of cause and effect, therefore we're determined. And again, you can go two ways on that. You could either say, wait a minute, we're not determined, Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty, quantum physics. Or you can say, well, maybe our bodies are determined, but our souls are free. So the opposite way. And that's usually the way like people like Descartes goes. Descartes says our bodies are mechanistic. Our bodies are like a clockwork mechanism. But our souls are free. Our souls are free to decide, to will, to make decisions. And we're not determined by our bodies and by the mechanistic universe. Let's see. There's the let's take the rest of the determinism arguments, I guess. So there's the psychoanalytic argument, which says that the influence of the unconscious rules out free will. This is Sigmund Freud's theory, or at least he started the theory, and the existence of the unconscious is proved via hypnosis and neurotic behavior. So you can tell that you have an unconscious mind because if you're allergic to Novocaine, you can be sat down in a dentist chair and some guy will like wave a watch in front of your eyes or tell you to close your eyes and visualize yourself in a at the edge of a still pond, and all of a sudden the dentist is in there with his drill going zzzz, and you're just like, oh, I'm in a meadow. Whereas like if you weren't in that hypnotic trance, you'd be like jumping out of your chair or screaming, like in Marathon Man or something, right? It'd be torture, right? But you can put people under hypnosis and they can endure all sorts of horrific pain without any reaction, which shows it's a real phenomena. People undergo major surgery under hypnosis who have allergies to various kinds of or problems with traditional anesthetic. And the other thing is neurotic behavior, that people act in ways that aren't rational, and there's good psychological explanations for why that is. I think about like the workaholic. So I've picked on the women with all the psycho boyfriends, that like this woman who lived next door to me, and she like her boyfriend like wrote his name in blood on her door, I think one evening. And it's like, it wasn't like she was unattractive or had an unpleasing personality. She seemed fairly normal, but that it was all criminals and drug addicts and drunks, and she like had some 9-to-5 office job. And I bet if I, sat her down on the couch, she'd tell me all about her father, who was an alcoholic or was never there, and so on. And so the unconscious mind, when it's young and impressionable, it doesn't understand things. And so it forms this irrational compulsion to find someone like the father to recapture this father relationship that was never formed. And the idea is, if I could find a substitute for my father who is just like him and get him to love me, then that will be like my father loving me. And that's like a crazy idea nobody thinks that rationally, but their subconscious mind drives that behavior. And so in this way, does a woman really freely choose her disastrous romantic partners? And you might say, well, maybe not. Happy Valentine's Day. your beloved, whether your relationship is good or bad, maybe it's all due to how your parents raised you. So that's the Freudian argument. So the Freud says your unconscious mind, controls you. Did I put that story in there? Just one brief. Do I have my story about hypnosis? Maybe I had it in the text. I can't remember if I stuck it in here or not. About the guys kissing at the hypnotist. I did put that in there. Yeah. So if that doesn't prove hypnosis, if that isn't proof of this, is what can, right? Nobody's going to do that in front of a crowd of students, particularly not back in the mid-80s. So, anyway, then there's the behaviorist argument. That's B.F. Skinner. Skinner says that behavior is all a matter of stimulus and response, that biological organisms act in accordance with sensory stimuli from their environment. They are conditioned to act in characteristic ways based on pleasure and pain, an attraction towards pleasure and an aversion to pain, and that explains all of human behavior, according to B.F. Skinner. And so his argument is that we need to figure out what makes human beings tick and what makes them do what they do, and then try to get them to do things which make society better. Problem with that might be that seems to assume that, let's freely choose to make society better by figuring out what makes us all do what we can't help but doing. And so there seems to be some sort of inconsistency there. There's theological determinism, which is this idea that God determines people's fate, and makes them do what they do, or that it's either God or Satan that you're going to be under control of either one or the other. And that's it for argument for determinism. Any of these names that are bolded, like Baron Dolbach or Laplace, this idea that I like this idea, if you understood every fact about the universe, you would be able to know all past facts and all future facts.
If you're God, you know everything? Is that basically the argument?
Yeah, well, the idea is you don't have to know the future. You just have to know everything. If you're a determinist, if you think about determinism, you don't have to know the future. All you have to know is every single fact about everything that's true right now and all the laws of cause and effect. Then you could sort of leapfrog back to everything that's happened in the past according to deterministic laws, and you can leapfrog into the future following those deterministic laws and predict all future events. If determinism was true, you would be able to do that. And you should know that Karl Popper is the guy who came up with the argument that Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty proved free will, or proved that free will was possible. And his bit that atoms are like clouds and not clocks. And that's, again, the argument from indeterminism in physics. Argument for libertarianism. The argument from indeterminism in physics we already talked about. The argument for moral responsibility. It says that if there's no free will, there's no moral responsibility. There is moral responsibility, therefore there must be free will. So, because moral responsibility and free will go hand in hand, and you can't imagine a world without morality, therefore there has to be free will in order for there to be morality. And if determinism were true, we would blame a person who did something they couldn't help as much as a person who did something maliciously and intentionally, or negligently, like the drunk driver. We blame the drunk driver the same as the seizure victim when both tied into a crowd of school children. Argument from intuition is just that from the inside it kind of feels like you're free. It feels like you're making your own decisions. Determinism goes against our day-to-day experience. Every moment of our lives we make decisions, they don't feel compelled. Arguing from deliberation, this thing where you weigh alternatives, it seems like you're really weighing the alternatives and making a decision based on those. You're not just sort of going through the motions. Oh, the argument from regret we didn't talk about. The older you get, the more you have to regret. But the sting of regret when you think, oh, if I would have told her how I felt about her, right? Then maybe we would be together now, and I wouldn't be with this woman I'm with now, right? Or, I wouldn't have lost my true love if only I had been so shy and awkward. So it assumes that you could have done something different. So the argument from regret is this idea that if you think, oh, if only I had done this, that would be a totally irrational feeling if determinism was true. But this argument says that's kind of intuition, that you really did have the power of choice then and that you used it wrongly. You made a mistake. And that's why it's so it's so angst-inspiring today, because you really could have done something different. The argument from poor prediction in psychology and sociology is just that, social scientists aren't very good at predicting human behavior. Because it's so complex. Compatibilism, we talked quite a bit about the last time. Compatibilism, again, maintains that free will is compatible with determinism by redefining free will as doing what you want to do. That free will is doing what you want to do, or doing what you want to do free from coercion or compulsion from someone else. Free will is the coincidence of will and capacity, in the words of Augustine. So the idea is that if you're doing what you want to do, then that's a free act. If someone's forcing you to do something, then that's not a free act. Both those kinds of acts are determined. So a free act is a determined act that you wanted to do. A unfree act is a determined act, because they're all determined acts. So an unfree act is a determined act where you were forced to do something you didn't want to do. Like give a robber your wallet, pick something else that somebody might force you to do. So that's the compatible solution. And there are some counter arguments to that. I think some pretty strong ones, like the Manchurian Candidate idea. If someone hypnotizes you to want to commit an assassination and you really wanted to do it at the moment you pulled the trigger, would that mean that you were free? Because you were doing what you wanted to do, right? What you wanted to do was determined. Why should it matter whether it was determined by someone who hypnotized you without your knowledge, or whether it was, society or your heredity or your conditioning from your parents or what have you? And then there's this Reformed theology thing, which is just the idea that Calvinism to most people, which is another name for Reformed theology, and Calvinism are used fairly synonymously. So Reformed theology or Calvinism is this idea of predestination, that God blames people for their sins, even though they were determined to sin. So most people think that God couldn't justly blame a person for something they couldn't help doing. But according to Reformed theology, everyone deserves to go to hell because of sin, even though they were born in sin and they didn't have the decision not to sin. And so Calvinism seems unfair to almost everyone. And even people that believe in Calvinism, say, well, that doesn't really fit with my other beliefs, but I take it on faith. And so so this shows there's something wrong with compatibilism. Because if compatibilism were a consistent view, you'd say, oh yeah, well, as long as you enjoyed sinning it up, then God just can justly punish you for it. And most people would say, well, wait a minute. It's not my fault I was born in sin. It's not my fault I have this predisposition to sin every moment of my life. It's not my fault that I inherited rebellion against God from Adam. And so if that's not my fault, then God can't punish me for it. But according to compatibilism, as long as I enjoy sinning, then I'm morally responsible and I deserve any punishment that it might merit, regardless of how I got my desire. Okay, and I think that's pretty much it. So good luck on the exam. My off hours today will only be 3 to 3:30 because I have a department meeting to attend.
When does the test close? When's the last day here?
Next Thursday.
Okay.
So not this Thursday, but the Thursday after this upcoming one. The 24th. February 24th, 7 p.m.
So it's open right now?
It is open right now.